These last many weeks, I've been preaching on parables, many of which have been a little hard to really understand what Jesus meant. So I've really had to ask myself, what are we supposed to get from the parables? Are they meant to guilt us into acting a certain way? Are they just a teaching tool that Jesus used at the time? Are they really something to confuse us and to make us ask, what? Today's parable, once again, makes me ask a lot more questions than it has answers for me. Parables are unique for each one of us, and I'm guessing if we had to tell what the point of each parable is, we'd probably each have a different answer, because we each get to interpret them for ourselves. Today's is unique in a few different ways. It is, again, only found in Luke's gospel. We don't find it anywhere else, and it is the only place a proper name is used in a parable. The only place. So in this parable, where there is a name used for the poor man begging at the gates, you would also expect that the wealthy man would have a name. If you notice, they give him a name in the song. They don't. There's no name for the wealthy man. The other very interesting thing to me is that Jesus calls the poor man Lazarus. And we all know the story of Jesus' close friend Lazarus, brother of Mary and Martha, friend who died, and Jesus stood at his tomb and wept, and he was resurrected. Is it a coincidence that Jesus uses the name of his closest friend for this story? Was the name Lazarus common back then, like John, or no? So isn't it interesting that this story about someone very different from the Lazarus we know? Jesus' friend was the brother of Mary and Martha, and we know they had a home because Jesus came to their home. We know that Lazarus had a tomb. All of those show us that he had some kind of wealth. But this story, Jesus has a man named Lazarus who is covered in sores and begging at the gate of the wealthy. Jesus resurrects his friend Lazarus, but in this parable, he tells the story of Lazarus in another life, in the arms of Abraham. I find that very interesting. I can't help thinking that new life in both stories should have some kind of a connection. But as we look at this story, if we look at it on the surface, it appears to be a story about an extremely selfish and maybe even snobbish rich man who finds himself after death in Hades. And he still expects the poor man who had been waiting outside of his gate daily, he still expects him to come from the side of Abraham, from this wonderful afterlife, to come back to him and to put water on his tongue, or to at least go and warn his brothers. You see, the rich man had learned nothing, because he still remained in his mind better than Lazarus. Some use this story to talk about being wealthy versus being poor. Some use this story as a stewardship story to imply that it's better to be poor so you can go to heaven. while tempting, that doesn't really work for me. Because I don't think that's what the parable's telling us today. I feel like this story, like the life Jesus lived, is about how we live and how we treat one another in our lives. I feel like one of the most important phrases in this passage is when Abraham tells the rich man that if his brothers and him didn't listen to Moses and the prophets, why would they listen to someone who rises from the dead? Such a powerful word for us. It's powerful for us because we know what is to come. We know that Jesus is going to rise from the grave. We know that Jesus' friend Lazarus rose from the grave. And we know that even those events don't open some people's eyes to how we should live. My Jewish rabbi friend this week said, "Oh, I envy you for being able to preach this gospel lesson. How I wish I could preach it." And my title would be, "What is it going to take for you people?" Which I may have stolen a little bit of his title from him. But it really is the truth, isn't it? What does it take for us to live the way that we know we should live? We know. I mean, think about it. We know how to best treat people. We know the best decisions to make. We know when we're angry with people who cut us off in traffic that we should be loving and forgiving. We know we should treat others the way we want to be treated. But we don't always do it, do we? I think what Jesus is perhaps telling us in this parable is make good decisions. Treat others right. Don't think about the amount of money you have, and don't think it makes you better. Don't think the color of your skin makes you better. Don't think being a certain religion makes you better. Don't think having a better job makes you better. I'm afraid all of the above are getting worse in our world today rather than better. And frankly, I'm concerned about how we're going to improve that situation as children of God and as the Church of Christ. In Ken Sehested's blog this week, he published a story. Alana actually first mentioned it to me, and I read it and I read it and I read it, and I felt so moved to share it with you today. So forgive me, I'm going to reread it because I don't want to lose the details of the story. The article is written about and by a man named Greg Jarrell. It's Friday night, not long after I've moved to Enderley Park, which is located on Jesus' side of the tracks. Our living room is filled with teens. We're playing cards, not because we like cards that much, but because we like being together. The cool fall air has brought us in from the porch, and we can still hear the drum line at the high school football game just down the road. The hour is growing late. When two of our favorite young men come dashing in, they've been out walking and they've heard gunshots near them. In fear, they run to the nearest safe place that they know. They recount the whole experience to us, the proximity of the shots, the sound of the voices, their dash down the street. We laugh together because the narration is funny, though their subject matter is very serious. Humor hedges against terror, but while we laugh, their insides are rolling and ours are too. We all know that this is neither the first time nor the last time that we will have this feeling. Knowing that a life can vanish at any time and may be almost dead, our love for one another cannot prevent cruelty from snuffing out a bright light. We begin to settle back in and we note the drone of a helicopter above us. The police are out searching for a suspect. They are being aided by a few cruisers riding down the street, and we are grateful to be inside, safe and together. But then an officer walks on to our porch. I greet him at the door, cautious and respectful, and know that there are three others running down our driveway. There are two more policemen in our front yard to the left, three near the pecan tree by the street, two cruisers parked on the side of the street. At this point, it becomes clear that the helicopter is not just close by, it is hovering over my house. We are surrounded. We are looking for two black males, one shorter than the other, wearing dark clothes. I am told two who match that description were seen entering your house a few moments ago. This description fits basically every pair of black males on any street at night, which I now know was the point. To live with sun-kissed skin is to always be suspect. The concentration of melanin constitutes the crime. I did not yet know that, but the lesson comes down hard on me and immediately. In any neighborhood where the disinherited stand, as Howard Thurman says, with their backs against the wall, the freedom to move without restriction can be seized at any moment. Worse, life can be snuffed out. It can be ended in public, on video, for the whole world to see, and no one will be held responsible. I tried to explain to the officer, these children who just entered my house are looking for safety. I know them, and I can assure you that they are not responsible. You're in the wrong place, and the real suspects are getting further away. Nothing works. We discuss, insofar as you can have a discussion, when the other side is fortified by a dozen armed men and a helicopter droning overhead. The course of action is laid out to us in this way. The victim of an attempted carjacking is one block over in a patrol car. The two young men are to walk out onto our porch, and an officer will drive the victim by our house. Every police car is equipped with a blinding light mounted to our roof. They will stop the car, shine the light onto our boys for the victim to see. He will either positively or negatively identify them. We are surrounded. We are nervous, and we do not know what to do. We intuit this is risky, but the boys, portraying confidence in themselves, insist that they should do it. Out of options, the rest of us adults choose the only thing left. We will all join the lineup as well. I do not know if allowing those young men to step outside was the right thing to do in that situation. At that moment, I did not perceive that we had a choice. Here is what I do know. I know that when the weight of a system designed to crush people you love is bearing down on your friends, you stand next to them. You become potential suspects, loving accomplices. When you love your neighbor, you stand shoulder to shoulder to stare down the heat of the blinding white gaze. When the spotlight is robbing them of their dignity, turning boys into men far too young, you keep your eyes open and refuse to look away. When you can, you stand in front of those boys using your body as a shield. You become a party to the crime of demanding full humanity and nothing less. when you still see that light later that night, because it has seared your retinas, you sit with the scars. The scales will soon begin to fall off your eyes. You learn that the Damascus Road runs through your neighborhood. The call comes. These are not the guys. But our legs still tremble. Our relief is tempered by cold reality. It's not hard to see that having a burning, blinding spotlight aimed at them is not new for my friends. I sense that the hounds of hell, in Thurman's phrase, will show up in many forms. They will always be nipping at my neighbor's heels. Standing next to one another, holding hands and praying is all we can do sometimes. Sometimes that prayer even works. But the day is coming when it will not be enough. Here is what I know. Years later, for all of us, but especially for those of us who believe we are white, the day has come where our prayers are no longer enough. No, that is not quite correct. That day came a long time ago. We have been told for decades, even centuries, about the destruction that has been wrought in black communities around our country. Much of this destruction has been entirely legal. And now we live in a day where only obstinance and indifference can explain our ongoing recalcitrance. We have refused to listen, refused to believe. The terror of the gaze of white supremacy continues beating down upon children of God, and now we are seeing it ourselves through cell phone videos, surveillance footage, and body cameras. There is no sand left to bury our heads in. The spotlight is on all of us today. We may risk burning our skin and damaging our eyes, but the call is as clear as it has ever been. Join the lineup. Get in the streets. Raise a ruckus in the boardroom and the council chambers and at your family reunion. Commandeer a pulpit. Take over a highway. Examine your own soul. Stop believing the lie. Raise up your children in truth. Neither dispassionate analysis, nor careful moderation, nor silent contentment, nor running away and pretending not to see will suffice any longer. It's time to show up, to stand up, and to put ourselves on the line for justice. Love compels us, and is only love given birth in flesh that will finally save us. That story moved me. How do we stand on the porch with those around us? Not just those whose color is different from us, but those who differ in so many ways. Yesterday, many of us gathered together and walked a walk for NAMI, the National Association of Mental Illness, where thousands walked to raise money, but also to raise awareness of an illness that is not controlled by us, an illness that does not make another person less than. How does love compel us? How do we give birth to love in the flesh, here and now? This very moment, God gave birth to love in the flesh through Jesus Christ. How do we continue that love today? How do we continue in the midst of all the heartache and the pain in this world and in this country? May we as children of God, may we as the church of Jesus Christ, be open to seeing the way that we can give birth to love in the place of anger and hatred. Show love. Amen and amen.